and welcome to episode 443 of the Crate and Crowbar, a gaming podcast being recorded on the 5th of March, 2025. At least it's hopefully being recorded on the 5th of March, 2025. We pray to the voiceover IP Rat King we've assembled from increasingly useless and incompatible pieces of subscription software to spare our recording and render unto us a podcast. Rather than an internal loading pinwheel or unjoinable call or some sort of microphone-based turf war between Teams and Hangouts and Zencaster. Joining me on this exciting journey this evening is Tom Senior.
Good evening, good day. And so if I'm speaking in a sort of rat voice, that is the fault of the Rat King that we've assembled this evening. Apologies for any distinct lack of microphone quality. We thought we'd just get a pod out just because we've got loads to say and there's loads of stuff to talk about.
Most important of which is congratulating your fellow Tom.
Absolutely.
Tom Francis, fellow podcaster, on his nomination, his BAFTA nomination for Best Game Design for Tactical Breach Wizards, which was announced day before yesterday. I don't know.
Yeah, fabulous.
A very deserved nomination, and it should deserve a win. But whether it will beat out the likes of The Legends of Zelda, Echoes of Wisdom, or indeed Balatro, remains to be seen. I think it should. Honestly.
Those two, yeah. We've got Black Myth Wukong, which I've been playing a bunch of.
Oh, those are best game nominations. Tom's nominated on the best game design.
I'm in the wrong bit.
The BAFTA's website is absolutely baffling. I guess that's what BAF stands for. Baffling Television Awards.
Anyone that wants to give me a call could help them out with this. So game design, Animal Well, Astrobot is on there, Blatter is on there, Helldivers 2, which is a really interesting choice. I think it's cool that it's in there, actually, given that it's a piece of social design as much as anything. Legend of Zelda, it's just as a fabulous sandbox, and obviously Tom and Tactical Breach Wizards. And we just think Tom should win this one. there's no kind of, you know, attempt to be
fair
about this. It's just amazing. It's great to see the game in there. So what do you think about the BAFTA noms, Marsh, when you're going through them?
Like, generally, I think it's a pretty strong selection of games in all of the categories this year. I don't really have a beef with much of anything. The only thing that I'm really confused about is the narrative category, which just seems... I was complaining about this the other day in our private Discord, and Alex quipped that it was the biggest narrative that they were awarding. And that seems to be true. Like, everything in there is very, like... They're all very narrative-forward games, but they're not... I wouldn't say they're necessarily pushing forward the medium in any way or particularly subtle or interesting or particularly well written in any of the instances. And one of them's like a remake of a game. So I don't, that feels a bit of a sort of slightly cheap inclusion.
So we've got Black Myth Wukong, Dragon Age the Veilguard, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, Mess 4 ReFantazio, Senua's Saga, Hellblade 2, and Still Wakes the Deep. That is the narrative category. And those are, I've played Wukong, Final Fantasy, and ReFantazio. I played the first Hellblade game, I've not played the second one yet. That seems like a cool category, to be fair. Like, just to start, before we dig into like whether they're narratively interesting, like those are cool games. I would say you mentioned like narrative being at the front of them. Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is spectacular in many ways, but it is a game that is utterly padded with busy work. Like, it's a huge, it extends and stretches the sort of second act of Final Fantasy VII's story into a series of massive open world areas where you fight a bunch of stuff and incrementally gain experience. The narrative of it, I think, is lost in all that. So I think there's not to, you know, get all lunar narrative distance on it, but actually, I think when you're considering how the narrative is incorporated into a game, feels like it should be entwined, perhaps because otherwise you're watching a series of narrative cutscenes, which might be very impressively produced and faithful to the original, but nonetheless a series of cutscenes that happen every 30 to 50 minutes. And in between those moments, nothing you're actually doing is really part of that. And that's, for me, like, Final Fantasy VII's remake is very much that. Where I love Final Fantasy VII, by the way. Like, it was a really formative game, and I was growing up on the at it on PS2 and played it again on PC, and I've really enjoyed the nostalgia element of it. And I like the story to some extent, but I don't think that I do think it, I think the story is diluted by the design. Like, if you talk about narrative design, the design is fighting the narrative in this particular instance, because it's simply these beautifully produced, incredible renditions of characters that you knew as a teenager. And then you have to sort of do busy work for idiots in a field, and then just kill probably like 20 things to level up, and then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not so dissimilar from other games in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, the narrative name is kind of ambiguous here. Do they mean narrative in some sort of holistic way, in the way that it is delivered through the game? Do they mean purely in the writing? Do they mean in the performance capture? I mean, Senua's Sacrifice, Hellblade 2, amazing performance capture, but you know, is it a particularly deep or interesting story? I don't know. I still Wakes the Deep, I think, you know, they've dared to include Glaswegians in their cast, which is a bold move, and I congratulate them on that. And I think there's a lot to be said about the way that that game deals with like inter-character dialogue and the way it's been written to capture regional accents from Britain. I think that's unusual and interesting. It is just the thing on a on an o on an oil rig, though. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't think any of these games are like disgusting or anything. It's just interesting that these are narrative games which have very kind of like ostentatious production values, generally speaking. And whereas, like, if I think back, I think this has been a great year for narrative in games. I can easily think of six games that I would say would be, you know, would be among the best in the last decade of a, you know, occurred in the last year. And yet none of those are on this list. Like, you know, Tactical Breach Wizards again has a really good script. And it's mouthwashing. I thought we discussed that on the podcast. Thank goodness You're Here is got it's full of brilliant joke writing. Arco, it's got a really interesting relationship with Mesoamerican culture and in history. Lorelei and the Laser Eyes, very thoughtful game about the nature of art. Indica is absolutely batshit mad and has some interesting performance capture. All of those games, I just think, like, I'm not picking those because I'd say, oh, they deserve to win this category, but I'm just like, there was so much more interesting happening this year than your, like, your cutscene battle games that seem to dominate this category.
Yeah, I mean, the cutscene battle thing, Black Myth Wukong, is the epitome of that. It's just it's really fun because it's a fiction of its characters, and the gods of that mythology are really exciting, but they're exciting when you get to hit them with a stick. They're not particularly exciting when they're talking or doing anything like narratively. But I mean, I with that one, is are you crediting the narrative to the original mythology, which is deep and rich and just fascinating and has endless like interpretations, and this is a kind of part of the pantheon of interpretations for this thing. And that's kind of cool that video games can do that. But then, as a sort of, then it's, but it can't just be a totem. Like, it still has to do the good narrative work of being interesting, and then having, like, you know, interesting writing and getting you invested in something. So, yeah, I do like these lists, though. Like, I do like list features and awards for this reason, because you get to complain about them. And and also, like, for me, speaking for myself, like, define my tastes in response to them.
It's
like,
right, you get to interrogate your own priorities.
Yeah,
as a result, I think that's useful.
So yeah, this isn't to sort of like absolutely trash the BAFTAs or anything. I thought that was it. Metaphor for Fantasio, I think, is an interesting example because it's I've played loads of it. I think I'm in the final quarter, which for a game from that studio who also made Persona, and those games are just infinitely long. I still haven't finished Persona 5, and I've literally put 120 hours into it, and Emma has put 100 hours into it, my partner. We both love it, and it's never going to end. I enjoy the Persona. I think narratively they're much stronger than Rue Fantasio because they're about extrapolating high school anxieties about adults into quest lines, and there is lots of grinding and stuff, and there's definitely lots of kind of like really gritty mechanics and sort of long going up through floors to get to a boss in between those bits. But as you're going up those floors, you're having these little rest moments where you're talking to your companions, who are also students from the same school, the same area, and they're all like constantly communicating with you, like, and they talk to you about their problems with, they don't care about the demons so much, they care more about the adults in the real world. And this is kind of it's a classic piece of young adult fiction in that regard. I think it's like a really strong, the Persona game is a really strong piece of young adult fiction. Metaphor ReFantasio, I think it has really strong characters. It's got a really good group of misfits and characters with very strong motivations. But I do think, like, because it is also a very stupid commentary on racism, has probably given it a bit more mileage than it deserves, honestly, because as part of this, like, from the start, you read a book that is from a different world other than the world that you're in, this fantasy world. And in this other world, everyone looks basically the same and everyone gets along and they all put all of their resources together and they're describing our world. And in fact, in their world, they're all different fantasy races. And when you do encounter humans, which are an enemy in the game, they're all huge, three-story tall, distorted, horrific, modern art deconstructions of humanity, which is really cool, actually. Like, it's really, really good. You'll fight a thing like pretty early on that's just like it's sort of on all fours, but it's the back of its brain is over here. It's like one of its eyeballs is out, but also is a weak point that you can hit. And then there's also a boss enemy who's kind of like commanding the human. They're standing inside its brain can, its empty brain can, and it's all standing there, and you can, like, you have to bring down the bits of human to get to the weird fancy villain that's just standing there. And in that sense, I think it is very inventive and really cool, and it does tie into the narrative more than other games. But I do think it, like, the fact is that it's focus on division, racial division, is kind of like, I do think it does earn it more points than it deserves. And there is actually very common stuff for JRPGs to be able to comment on. And and all the moment to moment dialogue is just passable, like, at best. It's kind of, again, like, you're right, like, they didn't clarify what narrative means, like, how it's been judged and stuff. And I guess the purpose is, I mean, that's probably better for debate, isn't it? So that we can have discussions like this.
I guess they're all big ticket games, aren't they, really? Apart from, I mean, maybe Still Wakes the Deep is the most budget of all of them, which is not very budget.
Clicking through some of the others. So multiplayer, we've got Call of Duty Black Ops 6. Could definitely talk about that. Played that more than I probably should have. Tekken 8 is definitely a good shout. Weirdly, Space Marine 2 in the multiplayer category, I think, is a good shout because it is... not because it's a great game, but because it's so easy to just jump into co-op. Like, you can literally just, within seconds, you could be with a bunch of other Space Marines and killing stuff. And actually, loads of games, like, don't have the... can't quite deliver that.
I haven't seen any of the blurb around the BAFTAs, so I have no idea what the game beyond entertainment category means at all.
Just
looking at the games in it, it's a completely confounding selection of games. There's Tetris Forever. There's
That's been out for ages.
Hellblade 2 and Botany Manor, which is very nice. But
that sounds cool.
It's hard to think of a single thing it shares with Tetris or Hellblade.
I do like the idea of a complete surprise category. It's like, no one knows what this means. We're just going to talk about these things, and that's cool. Let's go for it. I kind of like that, to be honest.
Well, let's talk about what you've been playing instead.
Well, so I'll talk about the two things I've been playing the most recently are Call of Duty Black Ops 6 and Monster Hunter Wilds. Call of Duty 6, let's start with that, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
Yeah, so Call of Duty 6, it's the best Call of Duty I've played in years. Like, it has For Call of Duty, so everything I'm about to say is within the constraints of what Call of Duty thinks it is and is supposed to be for its fans, is wildly ambitious, the single player campaign.
Oh,
Like,
yeah.
there are like, there's a Hitman level in it, and there's just kind of, there's a proper Call of Duty like point and shoot level, proper kind of roller coaster, linear stuff, and then a sort of a kind of also a battlefield level where it's more open, you're driving around. So it's sort of flipping from lots of different games with varying degrees of success. It moves in and out of its like the single player campaign recognizes how weird and disparate Call of Duty has become in a really exciting way, because it's not only this kind of militaristic simulator where they've made deals with actual gun manufacturers and to reflect have their games, the guns in the game, like in a multiplayer context. It also has a zombies mode. And so in the single player campaign, there's just straight up zombies missions where you're killing loads of zombies. There is a mission that like massively references Thief and the Cradle, because there's a kind of zombie virus, a chemical virus called the Cradle, that has affected loads of things in this particular level. And what you end up with, I can't, so okay, I'm going to give a spoiler warning, which is a thing that no one should has ever had to give for a Call of Duty game before. If you want to sort of enjoy a Call of Duty campaign that is just absolutely going randomly from like one genre to another, just it really doesn't care, but it's really trying desperately to be good at everything. Then just like go and enjoy it. It's about 7 hours long, and it's good fun. But this horror level in particular, which references the Cradle, lots of you get a big huff of it at the start, so you're in this psychedelic state, and then that means that all of the enemies can be basically demonic villains, and a whole and there are like three wings to this. It's like a Bioshock level, honestly. I think they must have like taken inspiration from Bioshock, because it's like there's a pinnacle boss, but then there are like three spokes that lead out to different rooms, and each room has a different kind of horror effect, a different kind of conceit, horror conceit. And the best one is lifted from Doctor Who, which is I can't remember what it was called. I think it's like it's the Angels episodes of Doctor Who,
The Weeping Angels,
the
right?
Weeping, precisely. And so the conceit of this is that when you're looking at them, they're still mannequins. As soon as you turn away, they start moving to you at great speed, at running speed. But when you turn back, they immediately freeze just before you look around. But so you get this kind of like you're constructing your own horror film when you're looking away and looking back. Because when you choose to look away and then you look back, it's almost like a strobe effect. Like you go from them being 10 meters away to 5 meters away with all their hands up in your face, and then you back away from them, and then you hear scuttling behind you, and the sound in this game is really, really strong, because actually it's designed for multiplayer, and you're better at multiplayer in Call of Duty if you have headphones on. You're just better because you hear more, you hear where people are around you. You like, honestly, I've played enough of it to know that that is actually just a tip for being better at the multiplayer. They pay so much attention to spatial sound, and that like pays off enormously in this particular level. So you go through like your shops, you're trying to I can't remember what the objectives are, like press buttons or whatever the hell, but you're hearing things scuttling behind you, turning around, and suddenly there are like 20 mannequins that were completely still when you enter the room who are surrounding you, and then you can blast them, but you only have limited ammo, and it's suddenly they've created an entire horror game within Call of Duty, which I think was actually it's really effective, and it's way more effective than the actual zombies mode, which is a really depressing slog of a mode. So like they've taken all the sort of principles of the zombie mode and the leeway to create a fantastical out of military kind of context. There are designers there who obviously just wanted to flex their muscles, and they did a good job in the single player mode with
Right. I
their
mean,
plans.
it's worth mentioning that during that sort of Weeping Angel sequence, your way of taking out the main enemy is to grapple hook them and then slingshot yourself across the room to drop kick them, which is not a you know, like a verb that is particularly common to other kind of military shooters. Yeah, there's a lot of mobility stuff in this, which it goes well beyond what is, you know, usually seen in more mundane military shooters, and it's all the better for it. Like the way it exceeds its fictional remit is its main appeal to me, I think.
Yeah, Call of Duty for a few years now has been trying to escape being Call of Duty.
Like, yeah,
it's just really been trying to get out of it a bit, because it just, they know, like, they have great designers, they have like really good, like, you know, well paid, well staffed studios. They know that Call of Duty can be incredibly rote. And just, it has been really shit. Like, it just has been, like, so some of the mission design and some of the sort of mid-stage Call of Duties post-Modern Warfare, like, they've just been utterly embarrassed by videos of people, like, putting it onto medium settings and not firing a shot and pressing forwards. And you go through missions where there's actually no challenge. It's like a whack-a-mole thing where dudes pop up in front of you. The framing is horrible and like just ahistorical and just like borderline offensive in some parts. And like it's just, it got into a horrible rut. And I feel like Black Ops as a sort of strand of Call of Duty is well placed to actually break out of that. But what I like about what Black Ops 6 has done is that they've gotten away from the conspiracy theory stuff, which now is way more loaded topic than it was when the early Black Ops games came out. So the first two Black Ops games, you could have like the numbers Mason and have it's kind of globe-trotting conspiracy stuff. I like that they stepped away from that and tried to just make good video game levels. They've still got like the design around the way the guns feel and shoot and stuff is still immense. Like it's absolutely like, feels fantastic. And I think that I kind of like what Black Ops is trying to do with Call of Duty and Black Ops 6. And particularly, so this one has drawn some criticism online for the mobility in particular, actually, because the idea of people like diving sideways and shooting like a John Woo film is not like a military maneuver. And I could kind of like see people who enjoyed the early Call of Duty sort of militaristic games. I understand why they like that stuff, but also, do you know what video games are? Like diving sideways and firing your custom bright pink submachine gun and getting a Kingslayer medal for killing someone as they're standing in a bright pink van on Nuketown is the epitome of Call of Duty. Like that is what's good about it now. And I wonder what like your impression of the, before I sort of dive into multiplayer and stuff, Marshall, like, I wonder what your kind of whole impression of the franchise is, like where is that?
Well, I think people who remember the particularly drunken episodes of this podcast from a decade or so ago will remember that our feelings about Call of Duty weren't especially positive at that point. But I think that's partly driven by exactly the slump you're describing in the series, where it had still adhered too strongly to its militaristic traditions. It was very jingoistic, it was revisionist, it was imperialist and deeply unpleasant in its setting, but also mechanically extraordinarily boring. And I think it has more or less escaped that now. I mean, the fiction that it presents you in Black Ops 6 is no more closer to reality than any of the Fast and the Furious films. Yeah. You know, it is a globe-trotting sort of conspiracy thriller, but I mean, it's just so kind of outrageous and silly, and also it has this just constant roving mechanical focus. It abandons one thing for one section levels and just becomes a completely different game. Like there's a whole open world section basically where you're driving around taking out outposts that feels great. It's just extremely surprisingly mechanically robust for something which is lasts no more than an hour in a 7-hour experience. There's some great stealth stuff. There's a memorable stealth, social stealth mission where you're in the same room as Bill Clinton for some reason.
That's so weird. I thought I was hallucinating when that happened. Because they've got his likeness. So it's a kind of campaign rally or something. Bill Clinton It just appears on stage and it's just him. Like,
yeah, you don't talk to him in anything. I don't know why they even bothered to have him as a cameo, but it's fine, I guess.
It's just so surprising.
There's a really nice bit with some canals and I think for some reason, even though they have real Bill Clinton in the game, they create a fictional version of Monaco, I guess it's meant to be, or something like this. There's some sort of like corrupt party town. It's somewhere on the Mediterranean, and you infiltrate some some pseudo mafia style organization there from the sneaking into their very wet basement level, and just the mise en scène that they create for that basement with its canals and brick what are they called, vaulted ceilings. It's really beautiful. I could have spent a lot of time just chilling out in that vaulted ceiling basement. They have a huge manpower, and obviously, I feel like the artistic talents of those people have somewhat been suppressed by their need to make Call of Duty games in the past. And now it feels like they're sort of just they're just escaping their little box and they're doing whatever they want, and it's so much better for it. I haven't played any of the multiplayer though, so you have to tell me whether that's up to snuff.
Oh, the multiplayer isn't. I really enjoy Call of Duty multiplayer because it sources a certain part of my life where I've got 20 minutes and I want to level up a little bit, upgrade a gun, go to like two or three of my favourite maps where I know where all the corners are and what to do. And then that's Call of Duty for me. And then you level up through battle passes. There's endless progression in terms of new guns, costumes, operators, which are basically the characters you play as. The operators are one of my favourite things about of recent Call of Duties. I think in the last one, for example, in a pink jumpsuit, you'd see Nicki Minaj running around, shotgunning people in the face. There've been like, I think, three events so far. They happen about every 3 or 4 weeks. You get these multiplayer events where they're introduced. It's a new theme, and there's a little kind of mini track where you earn experience to get cosmetics, but they are themed, and the latest one is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So at the moment, if you're on Nuketown, which is one of the most famous Call of Duty maps, you're likely to see Raphael, Leonardo, Splinter, Master Splinter, just running around. I've unlocked a motorized skateboard, and when I hit someone with it, they turn into green goo, which might have happened in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but is now part of my arsenal. As part of that, there are guns that shoot lovely green racer trays, and then also like splat people in different ways. And a few weeks ago, Arnold Schwarzenegger as Terminator just arrived in the game, and you could unlock Arnold Schwarzenegger as a operator, walk around as Arnie, or his like melted Terminator form, the robotic skinny motorized form. So I think this is great. I think that what they've done is they've basically for the last few years they've looked at Fortnite and said, look, none of the various military doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that we don't have to maintain the fantasy that we're in some sort of military shooter anymore, ever. And perhaps even back to Team Fortress 2, not that TF2 ever had the aspirations to be like a militaristic thing, but they like very carefully designed their characters and then used the cosmetics completely broke all the design of those characters, basically visually, I think, in terms of all the rules that Valve had for the heavy versus the spy and the hats you can unlock and the abilities you can unlock. And it just became a sandbox playground where, well, let's just give the players fun stuff and see what happens. for 10 years. And then players are happy to spend £2 or £3 in terms of Team Fortress 2 just to pick up bits and bobs, cosmetics. The problem with Call of Duty is that the cosmetics are like, and their packs are so expensive. Like, their stuff is so, they tend to sell bundles, so Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles bundle, so you could buy that. But it's like £15, and you get like a few operators, which are basically characters that you play as, which is good fun. I think you get a couple of weapons, which might be reskins of existing weapons, but they have like cosmetic effects when you shoot and kill people, and then some stuff that you attach to your profile pictures, which is basically your ID, your online ID tag. And it's like, if that stuff like was like a few quid, I would probably be a customer. But as it is, I buy the battle pass because you get a bunch of stuff and it's fun to unlock stuff the way that I play. But it's not worth that to me. But obviously the reason it exists is because people do pay that. So all of that is to say, all I've talked about so far is the economy of Call of Duty Online.
Yeah.
And you might have noticed that I've not at all said anything about the mechanics of Call of Duty Online, which is to say that they are absolutely copying. They can't mess with Call of Duty too much. And the thing with Call of Duty is that you're supposed to build a weapon locker. It's basically the progression loop. So you want to have a nice assault rifle or two, three, and then one nice shotgun, which I've now found and fully leveled up. And you want probably one submachine gun, light machine gun. And the way that they incentivize this stuff is with daily challenges and weekly challenges, where it's like, okay, get so many kills with an assault rifle, get so many kills with an SMG. And then you level them up, and then that kind of encourages you to find the one that you like and that is good for the way that you play the game. But the actual act of running around and shooting stuff in the game is kind of a very individualistic affair. There is literally everyone else in the match is just stuff to be shot, and you're just like running around, or that's how I play it anyway. You're running around and you're just like, oop, head bop, oop, head bop, turn corner, hoop, head bop, and you know where the corners are, you know where the windows are, and then you get them, and then you build a score streak, and then you call in an airdrop, and then you kill four or five guys, and you get the classic Call of Duty thing of points ticking up right next to your reticle. Every time you get a headshot, every time you get a leg shot, every time you do a slide shot, it'll give you a little award that's right next to your reticle. And it's just absolute popcorn, moment-to-moment entertainment. And it's always been like that, but it's been perfected. Like, I really think it's not, like, an enriching, experience to play Call of Duty online, but I actually deeply admire it for how finely honed it is. And for, like, how well-paced the unlocks are, and how, like, compared to other games, you get loads of unlocks all the time, and there's always a new event happening, and they have the resources to do that kind of live online service type thing. Knowing, and I play this fully knowing that all that stuff will go away when the next one comes out in November or whatever happens. So it's kind of like a year-long sprint of nonsense content that pits the Terminator against the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and whatever the hell happens next. And by the end, matches will become increasingly bonkers. And it's almost like, for me, it feels like sports. It's like investing in like a battle pass and in Call of Duty Online with my time and with the battle pass money. It's basically just like, oh, right, I'm sort of in this, see how it evolves and enjoy it kind of on that sort of half an hour at a time basis. In the way that I would pay for like Sky Sports to watch the Premier League or NFL, just to watch NFL games, the NFL season. And for me, that's like, okay, so probably over the course of a year, it'll cost me like £150. But for me, that's worth it because I know I'm getting out of it. And it is, even though it is silly and it's dead time, nonetheless, it's exciting and kind of like in the moment, really good downtime. And that's kind of what I feel like what Call of Duty Online is, in total contrast to the single player, because it's utterly safe, apart from the movement stuff that people complain about. So the slightest thing they changed, people complained about. So they went to a sci-fi context a few years ago, and the online community like really hated jetpacks and stuff like that. They just didn't want that at all. And this year, there's more slide mechanics and dive mechanics and stuff.
Do you think they'll keep that stuff in?
I don't know. I think they were. I don't think the backlash has been too great for this, actually. Because as far as I can tell, like, it's still being really well played. But it's impossible to tell just as a player and just looking at Steam most played, and like from an outside perspective, it's hard to tell like whether what their actual concurrents are and stuff. And also, it's just like it's very mild stuff. It's like, oh, you can sprint sideways and then slide. It's kind of like what it shouldn't be controversial, really. I don't think it's like particularly broken. However, I don't play at a high level. I do play ranked every now and then when I feel like it, but I'm not like highly ranked or anything. So yeah, I'm not a great expert when it comes to actual crutch Call of Duty play.
It has such a large hard drive footprint, that those games, though, that I can't, you know, there's such a psychological barrier to me ever downloading it and installing it. Once I, you know, it's kind of a relief to get through the single player, because I'm like, okay, finally I can delete it. And then somebody tells me about the multiplayer, I'm like, ah, I kind of want to give that a go, but then I realize that, you know, it's going to be some desperate trade off my hard drive space to make that happen.
I don't understand that. Like, how can it be that this is the way that Call of Duty is as a download prospect? Your average PS5 hard drive, and Call of Duty wants like as the default install, like 220 gigabytes or something like that, but like 100 plus gigabytes, I think close to 200. And you can, you go into the setting, you go into your kind of storage management, you can uninstall individual components of it, and that gets it back down to just multiplayer. So you can delete single player, you can delete Warzone, and you can get rid of zombies, and that's how you trim it on your hard drive on console. And I'm certain there's a way to do it on PC. I'm playing on PS5. That's in that context. I don't know how big it is now, but it's not prohibiting me downloading other games. And it's you're right though. That's definitely a real trade off with Call of Duty, because the install sizes are crazy on console. Like, they're just absolutely bonkers. If multiplayer was like 150 gigabytes, I would not be playing multiplayer. I'd be playing other stuff. So there must be a way, given that almost all of the games aren't like this.
Yeah.
That's how Call of Duty takes.
Well, so you've also been playing the new Monster Hunter. Monster Hunter Wilds, yes?
Yes, so I've been playing Monster Hunter Wilds. I'm playing a lot of it, because I love Monster Hunter. And I spoke about the beta like a couple of months ago, I think, on the podcast. And I hold to some of the stuff I said there, where like when people talk about generational leaps in audiovisual experiences with games, the ability to portray just astounding scenes that are dynamic that you're nonetheless interacting with, Monster Hunter Wilds is just the biggest leap for me of anything I've played on since the launch of the latest generation of consoles. Like, it's absolutely astonishing. So like on the PS5, I don't have a PS5 Pro or anything. It's not like, it's just the normal rig. Got it on balanced mode. You can put it onto high quality and suffer horrible frame rates. I really don't recommend playing it like that. But I'm seeing like typical monster encounters with creatures that are like three stories tall, and you're fighting them, and then something that is like the length of my entire street turns up and then fights that thing. And then I'm sort of crouching there, and I'm sharpening my, like, I'm like, oh my God, I will just get sharpen my weapon, and I will just eat some berries and just buff my stats. And I just watch them absolutely tearing shreds out of each other. I get into my little dinosaur raptor steed, and I sort of ride around it in circles, waiting for the fight to end, and the smaller monster just runs off, and then a leap off the back of my mount, and like there's a chance if you leap onto the back of the monster you're hunting, you'll just grab onto it, and then you're into a huge mini game where you're sort of stabbing it desperately in the spine, and you can go back to its tail and stab it in the tail, and you go like back up to its neck, and then stab there, and then hold. Oh no, you got to block because it's thrashing around. It doesn't like you being there, and it's throwing its tentacles back at you and trying to scratch you off, like a cat. And then you go onto its head. You stab it there. Oh, brilliant! Loads of damage, and then it that causes it to ram into a spiky tree, and it takes loads of damage. And then you press R1, you get a huge finishing move where you'll fold your weapon into a giant sword, and it goes through its neck, and it's like, oh yeah, brilliant. And then you get loads of messages across the side of your screen. It's like broken, neck broken, wing broken, left leg broken, right leg broken. And then it collapses onto the ground, and then you dismantle it, and then devour it, and then wear it. And that is what Monster Hunter is all about. And the funniest thing about Monster Hunter is how much it tries to pretend that's not what it's all about, narratively. I feel like I should have given some sort of overview of what Monster Hunter is before.
Go on, give us the top-down synopsis, give us the rundown.
Top-down thing, it's a huge, it's a very long-running series that has held on to a lot of the tenets of even its earliest games throughout and has gained a devoted following. And it's about basically just killing huge monsters and then stripping the parts. It's a grinding game. Ultimately, you get parts, and then that lets you craft better stuff. Then lets you fight bigger monsters. And the great thing about the game is that there are very few games that let you actually fight big things without putting in huge mechanical conceits like quick time events and stuff like that. So if games put you in an arena with a huge monster, it tends to be like much more kind of prescribed. There's a prescribed way to go through, hit this bit, hit that bit, get the cutscene, get the quick time event, and then get to the next stage of the monster fight. Or if you're in a kind of like an RPG setting, like a Dragon Age type setting, you damage different bits and get the health bars down, and then you go to the next bit. Monster Hunter is an attempt to make that an actual dynamic action fight, even though it's a huge RPG with lots of depth in terms of the gear that you craft, and in terms of the elemental mechanical interactions between your weapons and your armor, the environment, which might be too cold, so therefore you need to wear different things, drink different potions, too hot, vice versa. Particular monsters, you want to craft certain gear that will be hit their weaknesses and things like that, and then you go in, and once you've done all of that RPG stuff, you go in and have an incredibly dynamic fight that is moment to moment an incredible action game, and that is the thing that Monster Hunter does that other RPGs rarely do. And like, not to raise the specter of like Dark Souls and Bloodborne, like you fight giant stuff there, and for sure there is some of that dynamism there, but it's Monster Hunter takes that to a different level where, like, you are exploring regions, and each region you're sucking resources and monster resources out of each region and building stuff to fight things in other regions at high levels. And it becomes like an actual ecosystem. Like, as much as the game story kind of pushes the idea of that it's an ecosystem, mechanically it is. It just that's what they've built with each Monster Hunter game. They've built a huge action game ecosystem where the RPG elements enable you to fight things, but then when you're actually in the fight itself is incredibly exciting. And I just, the balance of that, I don't think has been reached by any other game or series I can think of. And for all that, it's very hard to get into. It's very time consuming. It's absolutely baffling. There's stuff that you expect, like lock on in third person action games that it just doesn't have in the same way at all. And in fact, if it had lock-on, it wouldn't work because you've got like a dozen plus weapons and each weapon is so different. So you can have a sword and shield that will let you kind of stand in front and you can do perfect blocking, that, action game thing of like the very perfect moment blocking, and occasionally you can deflect monsters and then strike back with your sword. Or you can have a shield and lance, and that's a completely different way of fighting. I play with a charge blade, which is the nerdiest weapon. It's very good in like playing solo, where you've got a sword and a shield, and then you hit a monster a bunch of special attacks that charges up your sword, and then you shove it into your shield in a special move, charges up the shield, charges your sword back up, and then you enter a different stage of a combo where you shove your sword into the shield and turn it into a giant axe. And if everything's powered up, the axe starts spinning and it turns into a giant kind of chainsaw thing. And then that unlocks its own special combos immediately. And then, so you wait for the moment where the monster is particularly vulnerable. You can lay traps. This is also a great co-op game. I tend to play solo. You can lay traps, like electric traps, and it will shock them and they'll be there juddering, and that's when I pull out my giant stupid chainsaw axe thing, and then you pull out your biggest combo, exhaust all your resources that you spent the last 5 minutes building up in terms of like hitting the thing, and then it collapses sideways and a bunch of stuff falls off it, and it's the most satisfying stuff. It's just the most satisfying boss fights, and they're the only fights. Like, it's like every fight is the most satisfying boss fight. Hopefully that description gives you a sense of how much you have to learn to get to enjoy it, because there's so much there. But once you get there, it's amazing. Like, it's so good. I don't know how to talk about it, because I want to really get people into it. But you need, we're talking about recently about the session length. I think Monster Hunter's session length is like 90 minutes to 2 hours. Yeah, to get to sit down, do what you want to do, get something out of it, and then stop. And I think that's his biggest problem. It's not stackable at all. Like, you really have to go in with an objective. You have to fight some big stuff. And the investment of time is part of the reward. But at the same time, it is like a massive, massive time sink. The other thing is, like, for new players, it really encourages you to upgrade your armor and everything, and get into the kind of gear upgrade cycle. You absolutely should not do that. You absolutely do not do that. Like, ignore the gear upgrade stuff, unless you've already got the materials and you might as well. Those materials will be useless anyway shortly. Go through the story, get to the end of the story. My recommendation is, with the resources that you get, craft armor skin potion, craft aggression potions, and then huff those. Make sure you eat a meal before each fight, and just get through the story. Get to the end credits. They're not end credits. They're the end credits of the tutorial. That's what you've done. The worst thing about Monster Hunter is that it doesn't tell players that you're not working towards anything during that time. So what it's doing is giving you a tour of the world, it's giving you a story, and giving you a chance to try out weapons. And then, after that moment, you're in the open world, and then you're earning high-level materials. And there's literally, in terms of like armor gear, there's like lo-fi gear and high gear, which is like you press R1 or L1 to toggle between them. Which you toggle to R1 once the story is done. Everything else you've earned is pointless. it's just all the stuff you've earned, everything you've built, is just melted down, it's done. It's not even going to earn you much in the real game, which is what. And to me, like, you've got to tell players this at the start of the game. People, this is just... Monster Hunter, this is not a new thing for Monster Hunter, by the way. Like, this is always the case. People who play the game and who've played other games, they know that the story is a tutorial. But for people who are getting into this game as the biggest action game at the start of this year, and might be the best action game of the year, really, you've got to tell people these things. And, like, I don't understand. There are so many kind of, like, staid things about Monster Hunter that remain, and I don't understand why the designers hold on to them. Because it's just... I mean, those people, when they get to the credits, will just turn it off, I'm sure, thinking that it's done. Because afterwards, it's just like, oh, maybe you should raise your hunter rank and just explore. And as well, so you've got all the impetus of a story where the world is ending, and then when that stops, you just tell people, maybe you should just have a look around. Probably not, because... It feels as though it's like there's nothing else there instead of the entire game, which is what's actually there waiting for you after this. Like, way more monsters, the whole entire track, the weekly events that are definitely going to happen, the enormous expansion that's almost certainly coming, because that's how they tend to do Monster Hunter. And all that stuff is there to be accessed once you get past that bit.
Any value to the story that it front loads the game with?
The value is, it's good for testing weapons, and that is the trickiest thing in Monster Hunter, is that there are so many weapons that are all so different. You can basically try different weapons without losing much. Like, if you've earned loads in past the end of the past credits, if you kill big monsters, you get cool bones. The cool bones make cool weapons, and... But those are, you can make a split between any weapon. So actually you want to put them into your favorite. So you want to have a favorite or two by the time you get there. It's also good for teaching you the fact that just showing you around the different areas and how you actually, and the rhythm of Monster Hunter, which is to accept a hunt, eat some food, very, very important, grill a meal, make sure your gear's up to scratch. Make sure you've replenished your items, and then head out of your camp and go on. So there's a rhythm to it.
I notice you haven't mentioned the story in terms of the value of the story.
Oh yeah. No, this is not getting a BAFTA narrative nomination. Is what I would say about the story. It's fine. It's kind of, Monster Hunter is really weird because it tries to frame the hunters as trying to bring the ecosystem back into balance, and then the idea is that there are certain man-made things that are bringing the ecosystem out of balance, and the solution is to kill the biggest thing to reset the balance, so that everyone can, that all the local populace can live in harmony with the monsters. I'm amazed that Peter has not put out like 10 press releases about this game already. There's also the idea that, there's a giant sort of central Gaia source that is feeding each region. And when it's out of whack, the predators go bonkers and they get frenzied. And as a Monster Hunter player, when things are frenzied, they become high value targets, which means you get special loot, special stuff. You get frenzied bones instead of normal bones. And then you're like, cool, I will absolutely kill that thing for the frenzy bones. So the story is, it's way more developed than most Monster Hunter stories, this one. It's like a young kid who's escaped a monster, and you're kind of shepherding him through different regions. And, yeah, it's quite nice. And then it's just like, at the end of the day, I just want a bigger hat. And that's ultimately what the story's about.
Hat made of frenzied bones?
Oh, yeah. I can screenshot my armor. It's pretty cool. There's actually like a bit like, there's Dark Souls fashion online. Like there is Monster Hunter fashion, like people just like getting the best gear with the best colors, got more customization. You can if you get like a cool bone, you can just you dye it purple, and then cool, you're purple now, and that's nice. Yeah, and I so I've got my lovely loads of customization. It's really good. I've got my mount, which is like a sort of Velociraptor with feathers. They're really, really cool. Really good sort of fast travel device. Do go into the settings and turn off auto move, is my recommendation.
What does that do?
So for, when you get on them, they basically try to move to the closest objective at great pace. As you try to turn off and pick up some you know, herbs or whatever, they will like fight you at every step, and they'll try and go back on onto their path. So what you want to do is actually go into the options and very sort of narrow casting here, but like up on the D-pad is always auto run for your mount. It will always just go to the nearest thing. Very useful. But if you go to the options and turn the type of movement, a manual movement, to actually manual, like put it down one peg, if you press down on the mount, you'll then just be able to control it as normal. Point it in different directions. Again, Monster Hunter, just, it doesn't hate new players. It's just that there's so much they could do to make it more welcoming, just a little bit. And yeah, that is a frustration. I don't want to have to go to people and be like, go to the third page for the menu, because your mount just is an idiot and won't just go where you tell it unless you turn this one particular thing off. There's so much of Monster Hunter is like that. It's like, if you pick auto meal, eating meals is super important. What you really want to do, like, past the credits, is pick manual meal and pick your ingredients. And then your ingredients are actually super important, because they give you direct resistances and benefits that will help you counter the precise monster you're fighting. And stuff like that, it's just like, just tell players this. Anyway, it's going to spawn a million YouTube videos explaining the game.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be hurting them as a franchise, being as opaque as it is. I mean, no. I will never ever play another one. I remember being bullied into playing it in the office on a PSP, I think.
Right.
Maybe multiple hunters, Monster Hunters on a PSP. I can't remember how many came out for that. But it was always a joyless waste of my lunchtime, I felt, because there's so much like housekeeping in those games.
Yeah.
And it's you know, if you don't know what you're doing, it's just Owen standing over your shoulder telling you to do a series of completely incomprehensible things. Yeah, no, you turn off auto meal or whatever, you know, and then you go and have a incoherent battle with a giant lizard and probably die as a result of not preparing sufficiently for it. I just felt like there's, yeah, there is obviously a huge depth to it, but it requires just such a level of investment that I've never been able to get into one. I've never been able to like parse what I'm meant to be doing sufficiently to be able to enjoy it.
Yeah,
but I think the newer ones are more appealing to me, because back in the PSP days, not only was it completely inscrutable, but also the action of it itself just didn't sell itself to me, because you're doing all these kind of elaborate moves which didn't really feel like they had any kind of connection, like physical connection to the creature that you're attacking. There was something about the fantasy of it that just didn't work for me. But the newer ones, they really do look spectacular, and they look like they would feel good to play, which the earlier ones did not feel good to play. So maybe that's my way into it. But I fear that this franchise might be lost to me. I'm too scarred.
I kind of don't want to say this because it sounds like exclusionary, but it's purely a description of how the game is like. Like, you can't get into it every other lunchtime. Like, you simply cannot engage with the systems to the degree that unlocks the excitement, like, of the ability to understand what you're fighting, why that's important for your progression, unless you put in a certain amount of, like, of time. And for me, that's a bit of a flaw, to be honest, because, in fact, that's an enormous flaw. as you say, it is incredibly popular. And it'll do super well. And it is fantastic. I do really like it. I think there's loads it can do. It's just loads of just ABC basic accessibility stuff they can do still, just to help new players on board with it and understand the pattern of it and what you need to do next. And also just not lead people down a sort of garden path to the end credits and then say, well, okay, everything you've done is basically pointless mechanically, like in terms of the gear you've earned.
I don't think there's any number of purple frenzied bone hats that will that will outweigh my desire for a coronation chicken Subway.
And that's completely reasonable. I might return with more thoughts later. I think that's pretty, I think I've got the heft of it, though, to be honest. If there's any spectacular future events that happen, happy to sort of describe them and pass on the excitement. But yeah, it's a huge time investment and well worth it if you like a certain type of monster fighting fantasy. Though I should give credit to lots of the reviews of Monster Hunter Wilds, and so I should have written down the names of all the reviewers who I read. I thought it was a really good round of reviews that set expectations really well for the game, while explaining its excitement, but also putting in those caveats. Kez McDonald's review at The Guardian was cool because Kez's writing about Monster Hunter actually got me into the series in the first place. Like, her writing actually convinced me that there was something on the other side of the grind that was worth putting the time into. And that was just because the clear passion for the game came through the writing, which is my favourite thing about games writing, when it's done super well. And for that reason, like, and also, yeah, she loved it, rightly, because if you love Monster Hunter, you're going to absolutely love this game. I wanted to shout that out. But, yeah. Marsh, what have you been playing?
I have been playing Avowed.
Yeah.
Which is an open-world, first-person RPG from Obsidian Entertainment, who have made such games as the isometric tactical RPG, Pillars of Eternity, that satirical, I guess, sci-fi RPG, The Outer Worlds, not to be confused with Outer Wilds, the superb monk murder mystery game Pentiment, and they've also famously provided expandalones for various of Bethesda's open world role-playing games. And I mention this list because it feels like that's actually quite a pertinent history for Avowed, because it is very functionally indebted to the likes of Bethesda's earlier open world fantasy games like Oblivion and Morrowind. And it's set in part of the Pillars of Eternity world, this really colourful place called the Living Lands, which is this sort of wild and chaotic frontier where nature itself is rising up against the people who settled there. And this isn't where you come from as the player character. You are an interloper, an envoy of a distant emperor who has heard that there's been this magical mushroom plague and that threatens his colonial interests in the Living Lands. And you're also blessed by a god, as it happens. So you're sort of like this colonial super cop, basically. But what's interesting about it is it does make you carry all of the stinky baggage that that kind of role suggests. And almost as soon as you arrive, almost as soon as you get off the boat and head into town, you're assassinated by locals. And then brought back to life by a mysterious voice in your head, to everybody's surprise and great irritation. So you go about uncovering the source of this magical mushroom plague, and also in the process trying to work out what's going on inside your own skull and your soul and wider society. And of course, you do all of that in the time-honored RPG manner of doing favors for just about nearly every person who asks, all of which play out as like a mixture of sort of dialogue tree schmoozing and walloping lizardmen to death with no contrition.
Oh yeah.
it's quite weird because it has this kind of like fairly egalitarian view towards life and other fantasy races, that like it's the society isn't sort of separated by race so much as culture, which is different, you know, from the vibe of early D&D and some of the other kind of fantasy tropes that it's otherwise aping.
Mm.
Except when it comes to lizard men, who've got no reason to fucking live, it turns out. And you can just kill them. It doesn't matter that they're, you know, they have a level of society where they're making art and stuff like this. You can just fucking kill them. It's okay. It's totally okay to kill a lizard man. But anyway, I've had a pretty jolly time with it, even though I recognize that it's perhaps not especially brilliant in any respect. And it feels, I don't know if this is too bold of me to suggest, but it feels like a Tom Senior certified 7 out of 10 game.
This is, I was so hoping you were going to talk about this game, because I've not played it, I don't have it yet. But based on what you've said, Marsh, like, I'm already in. Like, it was basically okay in all respects, but also some as a sum of its parts, weirdly entertaining as a sort of Sunday afternoon game. You've got a couple of hours. Let's just kill some lizard men and level up and sort of have some chats.
Yeah, it's so there's, I don't know if you agree with this definition, there's like two different kinds of 7 out of 10 game. They're kind of the 7 out of 10 games, which are yeah, I mean, they're all of a kind of like qualitative subcategory, which usually means like a lean budget of some sort, and they achieve what they do sparingly. And there's ones which like maybe have one spectacular feature that sells you on what is otherwise an underwhelming experience. Mm. Or there are the ones which sort of like create this uniform experience of which is moorishly satisfactory without being excellent. I think it's the latter of those.
That is my crack. That is my absolute 7 out of 10 crack. Like, that is the original Space Marine for me, is just that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's like, that's a lot of faint praise to upload this with. But I did enjoy the game. I think there's a lot to recommend it. The standout feature is the world itself, which is just so vibrant, and it's incredibly varied. It's absolutely crammed full of stuff as well. Like it's not quite a fully open world. It's subdivided into zones, which is separated by a loading screen, but each of those zones is enormous. And also I think we're kind of past the stage of like open worlds measuring themselves against like the number of football pitches of content they have. What matters is that it matters, and you get a sense that like there's a lot of attention to each of those football pitch sized areas. And like every area in this game, every location, even if you're in like a single cave, there's like four different routes into it. There's like eight different hidden treasures. There's little parkour puzzles to find the corpse of a lizardman and steal its tongue, which is a useful crafting agreement. And like every vista, and it loves giving you vistas, this game, and every vista is just a sweep of interesting landmarks that all beg to be explored. And each of them is given like a fair enormity of attention and care in their design. It's a stunning game at times. There's like beautiful lighting effects, atmospheric effects, great attention to the sound design in terms of how it recreates a sense of place in these wildernesses. And also the fact is that the living lands is being consumed by this fungal infection, and that gives like all of its environments this exotic and alien and dangerous feeling of transformation, and it's so colorful, and the Michigan winter is so not colorful that I fell in love with it because of that reason. And there's other things to recommend it. I think the wider lore has some interesting. There's some. I mean, it's mostly fairly what you would expect from a trad fantasy fiction to some extent. It has its own spin on dwarves and elves and wizards and Italians for some reason. But there is this interesting cycle of reincarnation that sits at the game's core and a lot of the belief systems in the world. There are interesting ideas of godhead. You can tell that somebody has really fully constructed all the constructed languages in the various cultures. It doesn't bombard you with this stuff in like a nerdish, nebbish way as some games do, where there's just like reams and reams of, you know, like fairly dry lore about stuff. But you can tell that where it matters, like there has been thought underpinning the world, and so that all of its bits kind of interact with each other in ways which make sense and has consequence. And I think that sets it apart from a lot of Bethesda's, particularly world building, which I find to be quite bland. And I mentioned the colonial tensions, and the fact that you're blessed by a god. And I think that is the most interesting part narratively to me, that like the way that it addresses your god is quite nuanced and exciting. Not all the writing really lands for me, but there's the way that the god is characterized with their motives and their moods, and how you can respond to that. That's like the core journey of the entire game. And I found that a really interesting relationship. Much more interesting than any of the other characters in the game, I have to say.
Mm. So it's is it a party RPG, amassing characters around you, and then they part of the combat and your general sort of exploration and stuff.
Yeah, that's right. You don't get a party straight away. You slowly accrue party characters, and you can take out two of them with you on missions. That is like a core part of the game. I'm not sure it's the most interesting part of the game either mechanically or narratively. I haven't always enjoyed the companion dialogue. I wouldn't go so far as to say that that's because any of the writing is bad. I think they've just written quite annoying characters. So there's a guy called Marius, who is a dwarf, who I find just really irritating, but in a quite an authentically irritating way. So he's sort of... Have you seen that I Think You Should Leave sketch where there's like a bunch of people who are trying to play like a celebrity guessing party game, and one of them brings their boyfriend along, who is played by Tim Heidecker, and he's like 20 years older than everybody else. He wears a fedora, works in a cigar shop, and he keeps on picking celebrities who are obscure jazz artists from the 1920s.
I've not seen it, but I've got to see it now. That sounds great.
That's what this guy feels like to be around. Only he's a dwarven survivalist who's just constantly judging everybody on like their bivouac preparation, and it's just, you know, it's like, I suppose this is a pretty okay watchtower or whatever. And it's just he keeps on throwing in swear words from his dwarven language in a way which he insists is so casual he doesn't even realize he's doing it, but feels really ostentatious. And I've just had to stop talking to him because I can't hear the word Nimdoot ever again.
It feels quite well observed, weirdly, though. Like, that must have been very a crafted, irritating character.
Yeah, I don't know whether he's intended to be. It's just below the. I mean, he's not a total asshole or anything. Like, and all of your companions are great, like coded as your definite best friends in the world, whether you really want them to be or not. And it's really difficult to offend them. Like, I ended up doing something pretty bad and killing a bunch of one of their friends. The guy was just like, "Ah, well, I kind of guess you decided what you had to do was best." And he just resolves himself to it, and you're like, "I'm with you to the end." Okay.
I'm not sure if that's more annoying or not than the other guy.
Well, I mean, I was grateful because I actually quite like that character. He's like a beefy fish man. But he's sort of designed to be inoffensive in a way. Like he's very much your neutral good starter companion who is basically up for anything. I understand mechanically and through narrative design why it's useful to have that character, but it also does mean that he doesn't have a lot of edges, which is maybe good. I don't know. Some of the others are like, you've also got like a healer science lady who I didn't hate, but also Also, I struggle to think of any other adjectives with which to describe her, to be honest. And then there's the other one is, by contrast, a horny archaeologist magic gremlin, who is as colourful as that sounds. I mean, she's literally colourful because she has pink fur, but her shtick is very like Queenie out of Blackadder, which, I mean, you need to love. Because she becomes quite a necessary companion for the final third of the game, because she's the only party member who can dispel illusions, which are like content gating illusions. And I confess, okay. I did not love her. but I don't know. It is a really difficult task because you've got to make these characters who you spend dozens of hours with. You need to have them like sell an idea of themselves consistently, which will be parsable by people who aren't paying attention and people who are paying attention both, but you can't double down so hard on that idea that it becomes grating. I don't really know what there is like a comfortable solution to that, really. I wonder if it's that you're at a bigger risk of your characters being annoying if they just express themselves through their interests or through catchphrases, rather than having some sort of consistent personality that they fall back on. I'm not sure. I don't think the game falls too much into that trap, but I didn't absolutely love their companionship, which is unfortunate because that it does play such a large role in the game. And none of them are really any use in combat either, is the other problem. So they can be a temporary distraction, and you can send them instructions of what to do, but you can't send them instructions of what not to do. So sometimes they'll have done the thing already, and then they'll be on cooldown at a particular point where you want them to do a thing. So it's quite difficult to be strategic in your use of them, especially since in first person combat is very chaotic as well. You can't really get like a full tactical read on what's going on around you that easily.
It reminds me of did you ever play Dungeon Siege?
No.
This was an old, I think, like, I don't know, late 90s, early 2000s piece of game where you were basically a Dungeons and Dragons party. It was basically copying Neverwinter Nights, but with less of the story. And the best character in Dungeon Siege, the character I loved the most, was my pack donkey. And what the pack donkey does is it stalls all of your crap that you picked up from all of the enemies. You just put them on the donkey, and then it shuts the hell up, and then sometimes it will heal you. And I think that is the archetype that as a companion that perhaps needs to be sort of a default. And then around, once you've got your pack donkey, you can then have exciting and spicy characters around the pack donkey that is just a basically a mute mechanical support device, as we said. Thing. And in fact, like, you could even give it illusion magic to dispel illusions, like, level it up, and in fact, like, customize this main, whatever the hell, and then you can then have your Baldur's Gate 3 Sarg or whatever you want to do characters around that core mechanical thing that you're never going to get, you're never going to lose or get rid of. That's a very cynical way of solving this problem, probably. But I wonder if that's better than having to put up with irritating companions.
Yeah, I mean, I'm slightly overworking. I didn't find any of them totally abhorrent, I suppose. So that's, but I also just, considering that the game is, you know, 45 hours long, I think ideally I would have warmed to them more, because obviously you become, the game expects you to become invested in their personal arcs as well.
Right.
And I wasn't, on the whole, really.
You mentioned, like, first person. Is that how you're supposed to play it? Do you have options to pop out of your character and command people?
No, it's all first person.
Oh, it's all first person.
And it works pretty well. Like, the first person parkour is exceptionally well accounted for. It feels really fluid and good. The parkour puzzles are actually pretty well thought out. whoever is, you know, in charge of tweaking level design so that it's, you know, it's everything is the exact right distance apart nice. Has done a great job in this. Combat I really enjoyed for the first 30 hours, and then it became a bit of a slog towards the end. But I think that's partly because they just over-egg the number of combat encounters that you have towards the end in order to pad out to create a sense of escalating danger towards the end, and it just becomes quite tiring. But it's this quite vivacious and dynamic combat system. I think unless you like really drill down into sword and board over specialization, you're likely to have some amount of magic at your disposal, and that means that you can do a lot of stuff offhand or switch to mid combat. It has something of like Bioshock's 1-2 punchiness, where you're you know, you're chopping away at somebody and then you electrocute them and then you throw something else, and then maybe you go, if you're feeling spicy, go into your weapon selection wheel and dig out some other kind of magic that you don't have on a hotkey, and it feels like there's a lot to play with there. It is too restrictive, I would say. That there's, it only allows you to pick two customizable loadouts and switch between them, and that feels stingy because there's transparently like quite an interesting repertoire of stuff that could be at your disposal if it wasn't such a pain to change what your character has at any one time. And obviously the way that the game encourages you to level up and level up particular weapons and equipment means that you end up specializing in ways which I think is actually a detriment to the game. Like, they've designed a really interesting bunch of combat systems which are quite different weapon to weapon, and then I spent most like 20 to 30 hours of the whole game using the same axe, you know, because I just put loads and loads of money into it. Basically,
there's that thing in so many RPGs, and even things that are pretending not to be RPGs, where there's like an axe dead to optimal play. And I had this thing in Assassin's Creed 2, which essentially isn't an RPG. There are some weapon options, but you're not really leveling up. Where Chris can attest to this, when we were living together, and he watched me playing Assassin's Creed, he was like, what the hell are you doing? Because I would stand on rooftops with a double-handed sword, and then I would aim for guys, I hold them back, and he can wind up and just throw them. And there's... there's no bullet drop, or it's perfect accuracy because there's no physics. The game doesn't really expect that you will do this at any particular range. And so it sort of sails into their head. And also, not only does it absolutely murder them, it does so completely silently, because why would you code for the noise of a guy being hit by a double-handed sword thrown from several rooftops away? And that's how that was, to be fair, made that game better. Like, that exploit improved that game enormously, and it lives in my mind as one of my favorite games. But in RPG systems, that accidentally discovering that it's not optimal but comfortable, and without any incentive to diverge or try other things without being punished, I think is a huge problem with a lot of combat systems.
I mean, respecking is pretty cheap in this game, but I also had a magic item which meant that my crit damage went up depending on how wealthy I was. So I never wanted to spend the money to respec, even though it was like only a couple of hundred, because I was, you know, I loved my crits. But it's kind of strange, because it only gives you these two customizable loadouts, but there's very obviously like three branches to combat. There's like melee, which has its many subdivisions. There's magic and there's firearms. And so like, just why not give us three? Like that makes sense, especially since there's often physical barriers in the game which gate content. Which you need a particular thing to break down. Either you get one of your other characters to set fire to some cobwebs, or you have some fire starting ability yourself, or electricity ability, or this you know, dispel illusions ability. So it either forces you to have a particular companion for those sections, or it forces you to give up one of your loadout options just to facilitate getting through some cobwebs every 5 to 10 seconds.
Yeah.
I don't know. It feels like there's quite a lot of things in the game, which I think averages out as being a personally perfectly pleasurable experience, but there's like just this sort of level where things, you know, they work together without working really well together all the time. Like there's nominally a stealth system, but really there aren't any stealth affordances. And, you know, as soon as you kill one guy, everybody else aggroes, generally speaking. And so you can't really use it very often. Like, I mean, it's fine. I mean, it's okay to stay in stealth, shank a lizard priest, and then start combat. That's not like it's all additive, but it doesn't feel like it's justified its existence in a way. And this the same goes with like a lot of the ways in which you can command your other companion characters, and even like the animation for it doesn't always seem to pair that well with the combat design. So it has this really distinctive animation style where there's this big emphasis on keyframes, like in a fighting game, actually, where, you know, some character will be like in wind up and then suddenly, boom, they've hit forward, yeah. which works well in like a combat, in a fighting game where the characters are either side of a screen laterally, but when in first person somebody's winding up and then their character moves forward like 20 character paces to hit you instantaneously or whatever, that actually is just not readable. And since a lot of the game is about parrying and blocking, it just feels like, oh, maybe that wasn't exactly the right animation choice a lot of the time. Balance is all over the place as well. It's very unpredictable where you should go a lot of the time. But I did enjoy it. There's just like the amount of exploration that you do, even though a lot of it's just to get extra crafting ingredients, it's just this very kind of catnippy, very reproducible little dopamine loop that I just couldn't get enough of. And the combat was zesty and fun. And I liked a lot of the dialogue is quite interesting. Like, it has this very strange, maybe it's actually just like narrative design inconsistency, potentially, but there's this very, very asymmetric approach to dialogue where conversations, you know, like in a lot of RPGs, they play out as this like pachinko of different paths. Yeah. But in a lot of RPGs, they're very kind of like studiously balanced in especially like the BioWare RPGs where you have your designated options to agree or disagree or threaten or, you know. But here, it feels quite chaotic. Like, sometimes you just have to go with the flow because you might have one dialogue tree where you might be able to agree or disagree or threaten, and another one you might be like sympathize and rationalize and ask a completely tangential question, which is nonetheless quite interesting. And then you're like, okay, well, I guess I'll sympathize. But then you've actually given up your opportunity to ask that question ever again.
Oh, it goes away. Yeah.
And sometimes those questions remain quite pertinent. So it feels weird, but like, I kind of liked it. Like there was, even though I didn't quite understand what they were going for, it did mean that these conversations felt sort of like very fluid and unpredictable, in a way which was quite exciting, strangely. Yeah, I mean, at times it was slightly exasperating, and there's like the last quarter of the game, your character seems to become inexplicably hostile. like having a conversation with a perfectly nice man and you've got like six options to tell him he's a piece of shit. You're like, I don't know what's going on. Why am I being like this? And some of the kind of big choice and consequence beats didn't quite work for me, where there's like two bad outcomes and you have to choose between them, and it's meant to be a big, big, hard decision, but it's never really justified why you have to make that choice. And why are they bad? Oh, it's because of magic. You know, they're just magically bad and there's no way to do anything else. It's magic, isn't it? You can't say no to magic.
Everything you've just said has given me the impression of God of War Ragnarok.
Oh, really?
Like, of just sort of everything being sensibly sort of well done and sort of acceptable and with some character beats, but were nonetheless inconsequential, and with so and with pretty much pointless mechanical armoring, weapon gathering, resource gathering, then nonetheless feels fun because you're punching through chests and getting stuff. It feels like a sort of just it's a good formula. Like feels as though it feels like they've executed a good core formula. This has existed for many years, but with some beautiful beautiful environmental art, beautiful zones to explore, and essentially I'm into that because I love the idea of just going to a new place, and if I have an optimal path through the combat system, I'm happy if I get to sort of see cool stuff and listen to beautiful music and stuff. So actually it sounds like the audio sensory side of this game is just pleasing, like regardless of these little sticking points. To be fair though, those mechanical gates about having to have a lightning person or whatever to like, that just sounds like a bad idea, full stop.
Yeah, I don't know where it's come from. I think it's just legitimately maybe a mistake that they haven't quite managed to address in time, because there are some barriers which only one character can deal with, and you don't have like all of the other barriers. You can equip something, your character, but there's this one kind of barrier which only one of the characters can deal with, and it just means that, you know, you'll come across something in the environment, even if it's not on a critical path, and you'll be like, oh, okay, I've got to go back to camp, switch out my characters, come back here, right. Or you need to make a note to do that later. It just feels just weirdly unnecessary. But yeah, I would say you're dead on in saying that they've executed between sufficiently well and well on a particular formula, and then in certain areas they've really kind of over excelled. The environment design is certainly great. I think the overall kind of world, the overall arc of your character is genuinely engaging, and I was hooked into that story after a while. I think it goes to some interesting places as well. But 7 out of 10, at least, I would say, at least.
I will definitely play this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't regret having spent 45-ish hours in it. 43.5 hours.
I'm going to play this, and then I'm going to play Dragon Age Veilguard, which for some reason, as I said yesterday, much is occupies the same space in my brain. I don't know why. It just feels like a sort of perfunctory execution of those kind of 30-40 hour RPG linear mechanics with a little bit of a squad.
I would say that I prefer the writing in Avowed to what I played of Dragon Age Veilguard, where it's strange the kind of journey that fantasy writing has been on. So, like, at its inception, fantasy writing was this incredibly scholarly thing where everybody learnt fucking Elvish. And then it went through this period of, like, faux medieval, like the Ren Faire language, where everybody's kind of doing the "Wouldst thou do this to me?" speak, which doesn't, I mean, it has like an archaic ring to it, but obviously it's doesn't mean anything because characters of an era didn't speak in oldie times. They spoke in common parlance. And now it's just fully the parlance of 20 to 35 year old Americans, basically, without any kind of set dressing to give you a sense of period or location. There's a character in this who speaks like a football coach, like an American football coach, or he's always talking about, hey, it's great to have a win with a good team, and like, what a great squad we make, and all this stuff. And like, there's nothing necessarily wrong with this. Like, the idea of a squad isn't something that was, you know, like conceptually only possible from 1960 onwards or anything. So, like, I'm sure there would be medieval equivalents for that kind of thought, and so why not update it into modern English? It doesn't make sense for characters to speak with some sort of like false inflection, which suggests olden times. You don't want that necessarily either, but at the same time, there is something just jarringly internet age about some of the things that are said. I think I turned Dragon Age Veilguard off when a dwarf said, "I'm getting too old for this shit," or something like that. I was just like, "Okay, I'm out." Bye.
Well, I mean, that's just a dreadful cliche. I mean,
yeah,
irrespective of whatever age is spoken in. I know it is possible to speak neutrally. And say things without adhering yourself to a particular age. Like, you can pick up about idioms. Particularly, when it's most jarring is when it's saying something very straightforward, like, "Go there." It's like, "Thank you for accepting this quest, go there." Like, actually, at this point, obviously don't say, "I've accepted it. Thank you for accepting the quest, go there." But there's neutral language that basically eases the player there without putting a jarring kind of clanging discrepancy in the way of, like, before you head out. That's often, it's almost the incidental stuff that is the worst for me when it comes to that kind of anachronism. That's the wrong word.
It is an anachronism, really. I mean, in the way that these worlds are suggestive of a different time. I think it's maybe because it's like, it's not just that it's updating language, it is compressing their fiction into a singular monoculture context where everybody speaks like 25 to 35 year old actual play celebrities.
Everyone speaks Joss Whedon.
Yeah, everybody's slightly wisecracking and
is that, well, yeah, yeah. And obviously he's been cancelled and stuff, but like that Buffy the Vampire Slayer thing persists and has actually, I think, translated directly into lots of D&D podcast humour and stuff like that. And actually, so you do get wisecracking, but like you can't have Dungeons and Daddies in the middle of a beautifully crafted world like that is perhaps not about. I love Dungeons and Daddies, like, it's great, but it's probably my favorite D&D podcast, but you're not just going to drop that their banter into the middle of a serious thing about saving the world. It's not like,
yeah, it's a bit of a tonal switch.
Yeah,
I think Avowed does get away with it mostly. There's only a few bits of it which I felt rang untrue for me. It's definitely less of an offender in that regard than I felt Dragon Age was.
Mass Effect Andromeda. I think it made those missteps with writing in terms of rebooting that stuff.
I just don't know. Maybe it's because I'm basically a fucking wraith now, and aren't made for me, and they're very successful and they're correctly written because they're rightly targeted towards the audience that is mainly buying this stuff, and I'm completely irrelevant. And I embrace that irrelevance, Tom. I embrace the grave. Send me there straight away.
I love it too.
Bury me with my fusty old books.
When you said I'm a wraith, I didn't mean to say yeah, like I'm agreeing that you are a wraith. So I apologise if that comes across on the audio, but like, no, I'm feeling it too. It's perhaps that we're just old men.
Yeah. That's the end of this podcast. That is all the podcast that we have time for. I hope it recorded. If it didn't,
goodness,
you'll never hear this, and you'll never hear my quiet weeping will follow this podcast. If you'd like to send us a question, you can do so at questions@creightandcrowbar.com. We do occasionally answer them. All these recordings are uploaded as videos to YouTube, where you can see other stuff by us. The address for that is youtube.com/creightandcrowbar. Thanks as always to our backers on Patreon. You can back us too at patreon.com/creightandcrowbar, or you can simply join our lovely Discord community. They are lovely people, the link for which is on our website, creightandcrowbar.com. That's it. I've been Marsh Davis.
I've been Tom Senior.
Farewell, traveller.
Thanks for listening.